Chapter 15. Insects. Cardin did not look up immediately from the letter he was writing when the Lady Cheyenne, as she called herself, was shown in. Three ants struggled futilely in the wet ink, trapped. Everything else might be dying, but ants and cockroaches and every sort of vermin seemed to thrive. Carefully, he pressed the blotter down. He was not about to begin again for a few ants. A failure to send this report, or a report of failure, might doom him as surely as those mired insects. Yet it was fear of a different failure that tightened his guts. He had no worry of Cheyenne reading what he wrote. It was in a cipher known only to two men beside himself. So many bands of dragon-sworn at work, each stiffened by a corps of his most trusted men. So many more who might be bandits, or even truly sworn to that filth, Althor. Pedro Nile might not like that last, but his command had been to plunge Altara and Murundi into blood and chaos from which only Nile and the Children of the Light could rescue them. A madness clearly to be laid at the feet of this so-called dragon reborn, and that he had done. Fear held both countries by the throat. Tales that the witches marched across the same country were an added reward. Tarvalin witches and dragon-sworn, Aes Sedai carrying off young women and setting up false dragons, villages in flames and men nailed to the doors of their barns. It was all one in half the street rumors now. Nile would be pleased, and send more orders. How he expected Cardin to snatch Elaine Trakand out of the Tarasin Palace was beyond reason. Another ant skittered across the ivory inlaid table onto the page, and his thumb stabbed down, destroying it, and smearing a word to illegibility. The entire report would need to be redone. He wanted to drink very badly. There was brandy in a crystal flask on the table by the door, but he did not want the woman to see him drinking. Suppressing a sigh, he shoved the letter aside and pulled a kerchief from his sleeve to wipe his hand. "So, Cheyenne, do you finally have progress to report? Or have you just come for more money?" She smiled at him lazily from a tall carved armchair. "There are expenses associated with a search," she said in almost the accents of an Andoran noble. "Especially when we want no questions asked." Most people would have been unsettled by the sight of Jacob Carradine, even cleaning a pen nib, with his steely face and deep-set eyes, the white tabard over his coat bearing the golden sunburst of the Children of the Light impressed upon the crimson shepherd's crook of the hand. Not Millie Skane. That was her real name, though she did not know he knew. A saddler's daughter from a village near Whitebridge, she had gone to the White Tower at 15, another thing she thought secret. It was hardly the best start, becoming a friend of the dark because the witches told her she could not learn to channel. But before that year was out, she had not only found a circle in Camelin, but made her first kill. In the 7 years since, she had added 19 more. She was one of the best assassins available, and a hunter who could find anyone or anything. That much he had been told when she was sent to him. A circle reported to her now. Several of them actually were nobles, and almost all were older. But neither thing mattered among those who served the Great Lord. Another circle working for Cardin was led by a gnarled beggar with one eye, no teeth, and a habit of bathing only once in the year. Had circumstances been different, Cardin himself would have knelt to old Cully, the only name the stinking villain admitted to. Millie Skane surely groveled for old Cully, and so did every last companion of her circle, noble or not. It irritated Carradine that Lady Cheyenne would be on her knees in a flash if the straggly-haired old beggar entered the room, but for him she sat with her legs crossed, smiling, and twitching her slippered foot, as if impatient to be done. She had been ordered to obey him absolutely by one even old Cully would grovel for, and besides, he had a desperate need of success. Niles' schemes could go to dust, but not this. "Many things can be excused," he said, laying the pen on its ivory stand and shoving back his chair. "For those who accomplish the tasks they are given." He was a tall man, and he loomed threateningly. He was well aware that the gilt-framed mirrors on the wall showed a figure of strength, a dangerous man. "Even dresses and baubles and gambling, paid for with coin that was to go for information." That twitching foot froze for an instant, then began again, but her smile was forced, her face pale. Her circle obeyed her instantly, but they would string her up by the heels and skin her alive if he spoke the word. "You have not accomplished very much, have you? In fact, you do not seem to have accomplished anything."
"There are difficulties, as you well know," she said breathily.
She managed to meet his eyes squarely, though. "Excuses! Tell me of difficulties surmounted, not those you stumble over and fall. You can fall a long way if you fail in this." Turning his back, he strode to the nearest window. He could fall a long way, too, and he did not want to risk her seeing anything in his eyes. Sunlight slanted through the ornate stone screen. The high-ceilinged room, with its green and white tiled floor and bright blue walls, stayed comparatively cool behind the thick walls of the palace, but the heat outside seeped in near the windows. He could almost feel the brandy across the room. He could not wait for her to be gone.
"My Lord Carradine, how can I have anyone ask too openly about objects of the power? That will cause questions. And there are Aes Sedai in the city, you will recall."
Peering down at the street through the scroll carvings, he wrinkled his nose at the smell. Every sort was jammed together down there. An Arafelan with his hair in two long braids and a curved sword on his back tossed a coin to a one-armed beggar, who scowled at the gift before tucking it under his rags and resuming his piteous cries to the passers-by. A fellow in a torn, bright red coat and even brighter yellow breeches came running from a shop clutching a bolt of cloth to his chest, pursued by a shouting, pale-haired woman who had her skirts pulled above her knees and was outpacing the burly guard, who lumbered behind her, waving his truncheon. The driver of a red lacquered coach with the moneylender's gold coins and open hand on the door shook his whip at the driver of a canvas-covered wagon, whose team had become entangled with the coaches, the pair filling the street with curses. Grimy street urchins crouched behind a dilapidated cart while they snatched puny, shriveled fruit brought in from the country. A Tarabunner woman pushed her way through the crowd, veiled, her dark hair in thin braids, drawing every male eye in her dusty red dress that shaped itself to her form shamelessly.
"My lord, I must have time. I must. I cannot do the impossible, certainly not in days."
"Trash, all of them. Grubbers for gold and hunters for the horn. Thieves, refugees, even tinkers. Scum. Riots would be easy to start. A purge for all this filth. Outlanders were always the first targets, always to blame for whatever was wrong, along with neighbors who had the misfortune to be on the wrong side of grudges, women who peddled herbs and cures, and folk with no friends, especially if they lived alone. Properly guided, as carefully as such things could be, a good riot might well burn the Tarasin Palace down around that useless jade Tylan and the witches as well. He glared at the swarm below. Riots did tend to get out of hand. The civil guard might stir itself, and inevitably a handful of true friends would be snapped up. He could not afford the chance that some of those might be from the circles he had hunting. For that matter, even a few days of rioting would disrupt their work. Tylan was not important enough for that. She did not matter at all, in truth. No, not yet. Niall he could afford to disappoint, but not his true master.
"My Lord Carradine,"
a note of defiance had entered Cheyenne's voice. He had let her stew too long.
"My Lord Carradine, some of my circle question why we are looking for—"
He started to turn, to put her down hard. He needed success, not excuses, not questions. But her voice dwindled to nothing as his eyes fell on a young man standing diagonally across the street, in a blue coat with enough red and gold embroidery on the sleeves and lapels for two nobles. Taller than most, he was fanning himself with a broad-brimmed black hat and adjusting his neck scarf as he spoke to a stooped, white-haired man. Carden recognized the young man. Suddenly he felt as though a knotted rope had been fastened around his head and was being drawn ever tighter. For an instant, a face hidden behind a red mask filled his vision. Night-dark eyes stared at him, and then were endless caverns of flame, and still staring. Within his head, the world exploded in fire, cascading images that battered him and swept him beyond, screaming. The forms of three young men stood unsupported in air, and one of them began to glow, the form of the man in the street. Brighter and brighter, till it must have seared any living eyes to ash. Brighter still, burning. A curled golden horn sped toward him, its cry pulling his soul, then flashed into a ring of golden light, swallowing him, chilling him until the last fragment of him that recalled his name was sure his bones must splinter. A ruby-tipped dagger hurtled straight at him, curved blade striking in between the eyes and sinking in, until gold-wrapped hilt and all was gone. And he knew agony that washed away all thought that what had gone before was pain. He would have prayed to a creator he had long abandoned, if he remembered how. He would have shrieked, if he remembered how, if he remembered that humans shrieked, that he was human. On and on, more and more. Raising a hand to his forehead, he wondered why it trembled. His head ached, too. There had been something. He gave a start at the street below. Everything was changed in the blink of an eye, the people different, wagons moved, colorful coaches and chairs replaced by others. Worse, Cawthon was gone. He wanted to swallow that whole flask of brandy in one gulp. Suddenly he realized that Cheyenne had stopped talking. He turned, ready to continue putting her in her place. She was leaning forward in the act of rising, one hand on the arm of her chair, the other raised in a gesture. Her narrow face was fixed in petulant defiance, but not at Carradine. She did not move. She did not blink. He was not sure she breathed. He barely noticed her.
"Ruminating," Samael said. "Can I at least hope that it was about what you are here to find for me?"
He stood only a little taller than average, a muscular, solid man in a coat of the high-collared Ilioner style, so covered with gold work it was hard to tell the cloth was green. But more than being one of the chosen gave him stature. His blue eyes were colder than a winter's heart. A livid scar burned down his face from golden hairline to the edge of golden, square-cut beard, and it seemed a suitable decoration. Whatever got in his way was brushed aside, trampled, or obliterated. Carden knew Samael would have turned his bowels to water if the man had just been someone met by chance. Hurriedly moving from the window, he dropped to his knees before the chosen. He despised the Tarvalin witches, indeed he despised anyone who used the One Power, meddling with what had broken the world once, wielding what mere mortals should not touch. This man used the power, too, but the Chosen could not be called mere mortals. Perhaps not mortals at all, and if he served well, neither would he be.
"Great Master, I saw Matt Cawthon."
"Here?"
Oddly for a moment, Samael seemed taken aback. He murmured something under his breath, and the blood drained from Cardin's face at one caught word.
"Great Lord, you know I would never betray—"
"You, fool! You haven't the stomach.
Are you certain it was Cawthon you saw?"
"Yes, Great Master, in the street. I know I can find him again."
Samael frowned down at him, stroking his beard, looking through and beyond Jacob Carradin. Carradin did not like feeling insignificant, especially when he knew it was true.
"No," Samael said finally. Your search is the most important thing, the only thing, so far as you are concerned. Cawthon's death would be convenient, certainly, but not if it draws attention here. If it appears that attention is already here, should he take an interest in your search, then he dies, but otherwise he can wait. But did you mishear me? Samael's scar pulled his smile into a snarl on one side. I saw your sister Venora recently. She did not look well at first. Screaming and weeping, twitching constantly and pulling at her hair. Women do suffer worse than men from the attentions of Murdrol. But even Murdrol must find their pleasures somewhere. Don't worry that she suffered too long. The Trollocs are always hungry. The smile faded. His voice was stone. Those who disobey can find themselves over a cook fire, too. Venora seemed to be smiling, Caradin. Do you think you would smile, turning on a spit? Caradin swallowed in spite of himself and quelled a pang for Venora. With her ready laugh and her skill with horses, daring to gallop where others feared to walk. She had been his favorite sister, yet she was dead and he was not. If there were any mercies in the world, she had not learned why. I live to serve and obey, great master. He did not believe he was a coward, but no one disobeyed one of the chosen. Not more than once. Then find what I want! Samael roared. I know it's hidden somewhere in this Kajasic flyspeck of a city. Terangreal, Angreal, even Saangreal. I have tracked them, traced them. Now you find them, Caradin. Do not make me grow impatient. Great master. He worked his mouth to find moisture. Great master. There are witches. Aes Sedai here. I cannot be sure how many. If they hear a whisper. Waving him to silence, Samael paced a few quick steps, three times up and back, hands clasped behind his back. He did not look worried, only considering. Finally he nodded. I will send you someone to deal with these Aes Sedai. He barked a short laugh. I almost wish I could see their faces. Very well. You have a little while longer. Then perhaps someone else will have a chance. He lifted a strand of Xian's hair with a finger. She still did not move. Her eyes stared, unblinking. This child would certainly leap at the opportunity. Caradin fought down a stab of fear. The chosen cast down as quickly as they raised up, and as often. Failure never went unpunished. Great master, the favor I asked of you. If I might know, have you, will you? There is very little luck in you, Caradin, Samael said with another smile. You had better hope you have more carrying out my orders. It seems that someone is making sure at least some of Ishamael's commands are still carried out. He was smiling, but he seemed far from amused. Or perhaps it was just the scar. You failed him, and you've lost your entire family for it. Only my hand protects you now. Once, long ago, I saw three Murdrol make a man give them his wife and his daughters one by one, then beg them to cut off his right leg, then the left, then his arms, and burn out his eyes. The perfectly ordinary conversational tone made the recitation worse than any shouts or snarls ever could have. It was a game with them, you understand, to see how much they could make him beg them to take. They left his tongue for last, of course, but there wasn't a great deal of him remaining by then. He had been quite powerful, handsome and famous. Envied. No one would ever envy what they finally tossed to the Trollocs. You wouldn't believe the sounds it made. Find what I want, Corridon. You will not like it if I withdraw my hand.
Abruptly, there was a vertical line of light in the air before the Chosen. It seemed to turn in some fashion, widening as it did into a square hole.
Corridon gaped.
He was staring through a hole in the air at somewhere full of gray columns and thick mist. Samael stepped through, and the opening snapped shut, a brilliant bar of light that vanished, leaving only a purple afterimage glowing in Corridon's eyes. Unsteadily, he pushed himself to his feet. Failure was always punished, but no one survived disobeying one of the Chosen. Suddenly, Cheyenne moved, completing her halted rise from the chair.
"You mark me, Bors," she began,
then cut off, staring at the window where he had been standing. Her eyes darted, found him, and she jumped. He could have been one of the Chosen himself from the way those eyes bulged. No one survived disobeying the Chosen. He pressed his hands against his temples. His head felt tight to bursting.
"There is a man in the city. Matt Cawthon. You will..."
She gave a small start, and he frowned.
"You know him?"
"I have heard the name," she said warily,
and angrily, he would have said.
"Few linked to Al'Thor remain unknown for long."
As he stepped closer, she crossed her arms protectively in front of herself and held her place with an obvious effort.
"What is a seedy farm boy doing in Ebudar? How did he..."
"Don't bother me with foolish questions, Cheyenne."
His head had never hurt like this. Never. It felt as though a dagger was being driven into his skull between his eyes.
"No one survived. You will put your circle to locating Cawthon immediately. All of them."
Old Cully was coming tonight, slipping in through the back of the stables. She did not need to know there would be others.
"Nothing else is to get in the way."
"But I thought..."
She broke off with a gasp as he seized her neck. A slim dagger appeared in her hand, but he wrenched it away. She twisted and jerked, but he drove her face down onto the table, her cheek smudging still damp ink on the discarded letter to Pedro Nile. The dagger, stabbing down just in front of her eyes, froze her. By chance, the blade piercing the paper had caught an ant by the tip of one leg. It struggled as vainly as she had.
"You are an insect, Millie."
The pain in his head made his voice rasp.
"It is time you understand that. One insect is much like another, and if one won't do..."
Her eyes followed his thumb down, and when it flattened on the ant, she flinched.
"I live to serve and obey, master," she breathed.
She had said that to old Cully every time he saw them together, but never before to him.
"And this is how you will obey."
No one survived disobedience. No one.